Today's program was brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm-fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 156 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I am Sarah Kamen.
On today's episode, Leslie Goff, head cheesemaker of Consider Bardwell Farm in West Paulette, Vermont. Woohoo! Welcome to the show, Leslie.
Yay, Leslie!
Sari, do you have any food news for us this week? Did anything
That's so weird that you ask, Jesse, because the answer is absolutely. Well, I don't know if you mentioned that Leslie is a cheesemaker.
I think I did.
I think you did. I think I heard you say that. And it's really apropos that she's here, because a study revealed this week that cheese is crack.
I see that. It's all over Facebook.
I bet it is all over your Facebook.
It's so all over Facebook.
Well, this
right
is
now.
Something that I've suspected for a really long time. Because it's like, how do you feel about that? I mean, do you agree
with it? I think it's great for business.
I've never actually purchased crack, but I have bought cheese. I find it expensive, but possibly not as expensive as crack. Jack, can you weigh in?
Sorry, I was overdosed over here.
Oh, okay.
Cheese is definitely crack, yes.
Is it more expensive than crack?
Oh, can I weigh in on that? Well, you know, it depends on what we're talking about. Like, how aged is the cheese, you know?
How aged is the crack?
I would think you want,
the price goes down as it ages with crack.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
This is like a fine 1967 crack.
You might be surprised to hear that I've never smoked crack. So
I didn't think you smoked it. I just think you bought it.
Oh, why? For someone else?
For a friend.
Yeah, no.
I mean, honestly, I think this is just an excuse for everyone to get fat on cheese. I think that the study is a little BS.
That's what I've been telling everyone for a long time.
I mean, Leslie, what in cheese could make it like crack?
I know what it is.
What is it?
Because it said it in the news report. Not to put Leslie on the spot. Apparently it's casein.
Which, oh, the protein?
The protein casein? Is what is particularly addictive, because during digestion, casein releases opiates, and those are called casimorphins. I'm sorry, I didn't know this was a science show.
I think we're going to get a little scientific.
I think
cheese
I'm over
making
that.
Is pretty specific.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, Leslie probably knows what all this stuff means.
All right,
well, I'm just trying to pronounce syllables.
We'll get back to the head crack maker of Consider Bardwell Farm.
Looking forward to that.
A little later in the show.
My dealer's in the house. Okay, next up, the moment we've all been waiting for, an all-insect restaurant will open in London. Yay!
Fabulous.
So everyone's been saying that insects are the future of food, and I guess it's true.
No. I mean, not my future.
You don't know that, though, because in the future there might be no food except insects.
So, Sarah, that's never going to happen to me.
not you, just everyone else.
Just everyone else.
But at least this restaurant won't be open in London. We just have to go to London. It's called Grub Kitchen.
Of course it is.
Ingredients will come from an Oxford researcher's bug farm. The chef, Andy Holcroft, will create dishes.
The chef. Uh-huh.
Oh, don't be condescending now. He'll create dishes like mealworm, cricket, grasshopper burgers. Wow, they're really packing them in there. Holcroft believes our current food system isn't sustainable, but bugs are, so therefore, insects are the future of food, apparently. There's different things that you can eat for people who are a little more squeamish, don't necessarily want the full-on bug experience. You can order things with bug flour in them if you don't want to look at your bugs. But frankly, if you're not into bugs, don't go there. Right?
No, you're not going to set foot in there. I mean,
yeah,
people,
go anywhere else.
People can't even handle a head-on fish.
That's how true. Some deal with bugs. But Renee Redzepi is very into ants right now.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, if he's into it.
I guess we all should be. Okay. So speaking of... speaking of foods we're not into, a new report came out and said that there's a good chance your hot dog might have human DNA in it.
What?
Jesse's face looks crazy.
That is not kosher.
Right? That is so not kosher. And even some of the kosher hot dog brands came out to be a little subpar.
I'm sorry, but how is that? That somebody handled it with their hands and that's how their DNA got into it? Or like their fingernail or
that part,
an eyelash?
That's inconclusive. That part I don't think you can find out. They just did studies in, I think it was like 35 different... Oh, I'm sorry, 345 different hot dogs and sausages, such as like Hebrew National, Oscar Mayer, Trader Joe's, Applegate, Whole Foods. And some came out better than ever. Some came out better than others. But overall, a really high amount found that there was human DNA in some of them, but mostly that there was ingredients that weren't listed. So most commonly, pork was listed in ingredients, and pork was listed in like all chicken sausages or all turkey. Oh. Pork was like a substitute they found, or kind of like a filler. And even in the veggie hot dogs, a high percentage of them had animal protein in them.
Oh, well, so, yeah. I mean, that's okay. That's not okay.
10% of veggie dogs had animal
I do meat. Not feel like if you're a vegetarian, you should eat a veggie dog. I mean,
why do you feel like that?
Because then just eat a hot dog.
No, that's not the thing, because people just don't want to eat meat, but they might like the taste.
But it's a fake thing. A veggie dog is a fake thing. Unless it's like Amanda Cohen's like broccoli dog or something like that.
It's a fake thing, but it's still a thing that you can eat. And you with eat pork it in thinking it doesn't have pork in it.
All right, fine, Sari. We're never going to agree on this.
No, but that's okay.
Like a tofurkey. Like, come on.
It's
no
good.
Have you had one of those?
Yeah.
Isn't it just like all corn syrup and soy?
Yeah, but every now and then you get a craving for something that's like a hot dog and you want to eat it in a bun and put mustard on it. It's not like, you know, I don't have it every day. But what, you know, what if I don't want to feel like a loser at barbecues? What if I'm just trying to fit in, Jess?
You're right. Sometimes the salad just doesn't cut it.
Sometimes the salad doesn't cut it. Let's take a break. No better words have ever been spoken.
We'll be back here on The Morning After with Leslie Goff of Consider Bardwell.
The break song here today is by Keto. It's called Late Nights. We'll be right back.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State-grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arriving to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer, and trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm-fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit christmastreesny.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After. On the border of New York State and Vermont lies Consider Bardwell Farm, a dairy farm producing raw goat and cow's milk cheese that can be found all over the cheese plates of New York City's best restaurants. And the woman in charge of all of that cheese is head cheesemaker Leslie Goff. Welcome to The Morning After.
Thanks.
Hey, Leslie.
It's great being here.
Welcome to Bushwick.
It was a journey.
All the way from Consider Bardwell. So please tell me, how does a lady like yourself get into cheese?
I kind of just stumbled upon it. I started at Consider Bardwell about 10 years ago when I was 15. I started there doing the chores, feeding the goats, collecting eggs, milking the goats while I was still in high school.
What made you go there in the first place? Were you into cheese?
No, I wasn't into cheese at all. I ended up having one of my friends in high school, his mother was working there as the cheesemaker at the time, and she knew I wanted a job, and I have horses, and I wanted to be outside on a farm and working to make some money so I could buy my first vehicle, you know?
Oh, so you're like, I could work in an ice cream shop, or I could, like, work here, or whatever.
Yeah. Ideally, like, I was going to go work at a vet office and clean up after dogs and cats, and I was like, that's something I don't want to do, I decided. So
you thought farm animals would be better?
Yeah. I've cleaned up horses, you know, for years, so I was the same thing, you know?
Goats.
The goats make less of a mess than a horse would, so.
Good point.
But, yeah, so the goats were easy. They were small. They were cute, fun. You know, they're always curious. So that cheesemaker ended up leaving, and Peter Dixon came in and started making cheese at Consider Bardwell, working as a consultant. And he needed an assistant in the creamery, so I went in first and started washing cheese in the caves at Consider Bardwell.
Does cheese make less of a mess than a goat? Or
yeah.
No?
It depends. So I started working alongside Peter, and he needed help in the caves, so I washed cheese, and then eventually I was 17, and he showed me how to make my first batch of Paulet, which is our cow's milk cheese. One of our cow's milk cheeses. So I made that, and then I went on to make our Dorset and our Rupert, which is also, they're both cow's milk cheeses. Consider Bardwell also, you know, we have goats, so we also make raw, unpasteurized goat's milk cheeses, and we currently are making 3 goat milk cheeses. So we're making our Manchester, which is French tome style cheese, and our Danby, which is kind of like a Sardo, and Slyborough, and it's a wash rinded goat cheese. And the Slyborough is really cool because we're washing it with a local hard cider from Granville, New York, the Slyborough makers at Hicks Orchard. So we're able to, you know, use local hard cider to wash that cheese, and you get the fruity notes near the rind. So
you're making cheese from goat's milk cheese and from cow's milk cheese. Aside from the flavor profile, what are the other differences between those two milks?
So the biggest thing is goat's milk is pure white and cow's milk is, you know, rich golden colors.
See, and I wouldn't expect that because
you would think
the milk
opposite.
That I drink is white.
Yeah. So the goat's milk, they use carotene, which is found in grass, and they make vitamin A with it, whereas the cows, it comes through in their milk, so it's super rich looking, very golden in the summer as they're eating the green grasses and all the different flowers and legumes in the fields. And the cow's milk cheese, too, all the cow's milk we bring in is from 2 partner Jersey cow farms. And so their milk is extremely high in butterfat, whereas the goat's milk isn't so high in butterfat. You get less of a yield with the goat's milk.
Okay. So as far and they're as, also like, smaller, too.
Yeah.
My addiction to Kraft cheese, I should stick with the goat.
Yeah?
If I'm going to eat it like Kraft.
You like the goat's
milk? Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's pretty rare. Most people favor the cow's milk cheese.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because some people feel like the goat's milk cheese, you get more of like that goaty flavor, kind
I
of like
goaty flavor.
Yeah, some like sometimes it carries over in more types of goat cheese than others as the seasons go on throughout the year. We kid our goats freshen or have their babies, their kid goats, in March, and their milk tends to be a little more goaty then. And then as they go through the summer, they're out on pastures and they're outside a lot, and then this time of year it's breeding season, so we start throwing the bucks in with them, and then that the milk starts to get more goaty because of the buck aroma that they have.
So goaty, you mean kind of funky?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like when people like with wine say like barnyardy.
Yeah, exactly, barnyardy.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's
I like goaty wine. I think too.
I like both of them.
I think I like goaty stuff.
Well, I want to know, I mean, I think in the U.S. we think of cow's milk cheese all the time. Is it pretty rare that Consider Bardwell is focusing kind of originally mostly on goats, right?
Yeah, mostly on goats. Goat milk is a lot harder to come by. We at Consider Bardwell Farm are milking about 135 goats this year. Next year we're going to push 150. But goats, their lactation cycles and the way they come into heat, they really are only able to be bred in the fall. So you can't, it's really hard to have animals producing milk year round. It has to do with the lighting and putting those animals into heat So it's time, you know, for them to be bred and have their babies. Whereas a cow can be bred throughout the year. It doesn't matter. So that's why I consider Bardwell and many other farms are able to have cow's milk year-round, whereas goat's milk, that's a little more difficult to kind of come up with year-round.
Is that why Goat-tober is in October?
Very well could be, because a lot of the goats are kitted or have kid in March.
Yeah.
And by the time October happens, they're about 7 months old or
yeah. so. Patrick Martins, who founded this radio station, he talks a lot about, like, eating animals seasonally.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that extends, like, oh, you know, I'm down sure. to cheese. And,
yeah,
and,
definitely.
Yeah. And that was such a weird, or not a weird, but, like, a new concept to me. Like, I'd never, I'm like, I know, you know, certain vegetables grow in certain seasons, and, like, in the summer you eat tomatoes, and mm-hmm. in the winter you eat root vegetables, but it never occurred to me that it was, like, the same kind of thing with animals.
Yeah, definitely is. Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't realize that with a dairy farm comes excess...
Baby goats.
Baby goats. And when I think about goats, I'm like, where have I had goats? Okay, I had actually had goat curry the other day. That's kind of a very South American, kind of Mexican style thing, but in the U.S., like, we don't eat goats.
Not really.
Not yet.
Not yet.
You know,
like, they say insects, they're coming.
Yeah, exactly. They say goat is the number one meat across the world that's consumed, but it just hasn't made it to the U.S. yet, which is kind of...
Why do you think that is?
Kind of a crazy thing. People here just know beef, chicken, and turkey, pork, yeah. You know? They think a goat, why would you eat a goat? But why not, you know? So, yeah, you know, we have baby goats every spring. You can't milk the bucks or the little boys, so you have to do something with them. And so raising them for meat is, you know.
Does that happen on the farm? Does that happen somewhere else?
The farm raises about 35 to 50 meat goats. And then we end up selling them to a woman in Albany, New York, after they're a week old, and she takes them and raises them. We're so limited on space at the farm right now that we don't have time or the space to raise, you know, 300 baby goats. Every goat that's bred has usually twins. So 150 does means at least 300 baby goats. Rarely you get one baby out of that doe. You can also get triplets, too. So... You never know exactly how many, but you can at least say it's going to be double what your herd size is. Yeah. So
you said you kind of stumbled onto this career, you know, starting with just cleaning and things. And this has been kind of like a natural evolution of you working your way up.
Yeah.
But is this what you want to do now? Like, did it inspire something that you now are really, really, really passionate about?
Yeah,
or is it
absolutely.
Just something that you're like, this is just kind of how it's going?
No, absolutely. The cheese making is a really great, I love cheese making. I can't see myself doing anything else. Consider Bardwell's awesome. It's like right down the road from my house. I have horses at my parents, so I'm able to be home, be at the farm whenever I need to. I've been at Consider Bardwell for 10 years now. The first year I was there, we milked maybe 20 goats. So I've been able to see the change and the progression of that place build and continue to just grow. Like I said earlier, they're milking now 135 and moving to 150. When I started making cheese, all we had was one vat. So, and that vat was 150 gallons. And now we have three vats. So we have a 150, a 300, and a 400 gallon vat. And it's just been super exciting, and to be able to see the cheeses come along and be more consistent and just, you know, they're award winning. And to be able to be a part of that and help change the cheese a little bit and make it better, it's just been really exciting. And we're working with Murray's and creating new cheeses with them, and to be a part of that has been really exciting. I think it's really gratifying to work. You have milk at the vat in the morning at 6 o'clock, and then by 1 o'clock you have curds, and the curds are up in the hoop on the table, and within a couple months you're able to eat that and taste the difference, you know, from a super milky curd lactic to amazing flavors that, you know, they're coming down here to New York City and people are enjoying it. you know, they're enjoying it across the country.
Do you have a favorite cheese, or is it like picking your favorite child?
I tend to like the cow's milk cheeses. I really enjoy the Paulet and the Rupert. I really like the Paulet because it's kind of like a more mild cheese and a table cheese that everybody can enjoy. And it makes really awesome macaroni and cheese or grilled cheese sandwiches. And I really like the Rupert, which is an Alpine style cheese, and it's sweet and nutty, and like it just is almost like a dessert. So it's really exciting to just be a part of the creations of those, you know.
Yeah. How do you guys sit down with Murray's and start to think of new cheese ideas?
Well, they've really come to us a couple of different times now and wanted to brainstorm. And Peter Jenkalunas and Stephen Millard are actually coming up to the Vermont next weekend, and they're gonna work with us and put our heads together and come up with a new recipe. So that'll be really interesting. We have been doing a blue cheese with them for about 4 years now. So this is a new project we're working on this
next
week.
And that's not in the market yet?
Which
the blue?
The blue is. Okay. It's only exclusive to Murray's, though. Okay. So they're the only place you can get that is Murray's.
And is it a cow blue or is it a goat?
It's cow. Yep. All cow because we didn't have enough goat milk.
Is that one a raw cheese?
Yeah.
Okay, so all your cheeses are raw.
Yeah, all the cheeses are raw. Consider Bardwell.
So there's like a lot what does that mean? Of fear and like misconceptions about what that means. And does it also mean unpasteurized?
Yeah, unpasteurized, raw, same. Okay. Yeah.
So what does that mean exactly?
That the milk is coming in right off the farm, right into our vats. We're inoculating that milk.
Meaning like adding the bacteria strain.
Yeah, we're adding our bacteria, our starter cultures to the vat. And so our starter cultures are taking over and replicating themselves so that there is no worry for pathogens. You know, our milk is super clean. We test it every week so we know what we're bringing in, that it's not harmful. We have two partner Jersey farms, like, half a mile down the road from Consider Bardwell, and we have a really good relationship with them, so we always know what's going on.
So does that mean if a pregnant woman were to eat your cheese, their baby would not become an alien?
Yeah, I mean, people worry about that all the time, you know, but it's definitely not wise, I guess, for somebody to take that chance just in case, but I feel like our cheeses are very safe, you know?
Well, the thing about that that's confusing to me is because in Europe, like, most of their cheese is unpasteurized.
Yeah,
they eat cheese all day.
Yeah.
I did when I was there.
And that's the thing in the U.S. is you have to age your cheese at least 60 days, which all of ours are, so that pathogen would be gone, in theory.
So that's the big concern. It's not so much whether it's raw or not.
Yeah, because they're worried that pathogens can survive over your starter cultures and cause a problem. So that's why we have the 60-day law, because over time it should be gone.
Mm-hmm. But there's no law regarding unpasteurized or pasteurized cheese in the U.S.
No.
Because I don't know, I think there's just like a lot of...
Well, there is that has to be aged for 60 days.
Right, but like there's laws that you can't necessarily bring like unpasteurized cheese from the Europe and into the United States.
I mean,
did I say from the Europe?
You did, uh-huh.
Okay.
The continent, I think you meant.
Right? Sure.
There are laws against certain cheeses. Does that actually stop some of your creativity and the things that you're able to make there?
Not yet. Okay. There is talk that the FDA wants to push the 60-day rule back to 90 days, in which we are making a wash-rinded cow's milk cheese that's at 60 days, it's good, and it's ready to go out the door. So that would affect that cheese. So we're hoping that's not going to happen. But all the other cheeses would be fine if the law changed to 90 days. Our cheese Paulet is aged for 4 months, and our Rupert is up to 12 months. So the rest of them would be fine.
Yeah. Does eating so much good cheese ruin you for, like, most cheese?
No.
Like, you go out and you're like, this cheese is awful.
No, you start realizing just how good your cheese is. You know, it's always, I always like to go out whenever I can and taste other people's cheese. And sometimes you're really excited and other times you're just like, it's good, but you just realize how awesome your product is, you know?
Yeah, that must be a good feeling.
Yeah, it's great.
So I know that cheese is kind of a very specific recipe.
Yeah.
Right? Do you ever, because I come from the wine world where, you know, there's a recipe to it, but I think people take a little bit more freedom. Do you ever, like, kind of go rogue with your cheese making and experiment?
Not so much. We really don't do a whole lot of experimenting because there's so much demand for our products right now mm-hmm. that we don't have enough milk to be experimenting with. Ideally, I think the rest of us at Consider Bardwell would love to experiment and try new things, but right now we just don't have the milk supply. This year we did about 90,000 pounds of cheese, and I think the goal for next year is about 110 to 120. But unless, you know, we get more milk, it'll be, we'll see what will happen next year, I guess. But
so you guys are like, you call yourselves a sustainable farm. What makes, you know, yourself sustainable? What sets you apart from other so-called dairy farms?
I think the biggest thing right now that sets us apart is our goats are actually doing a 12-hour rotational grazing at Consider Bardwell Farm. Our farmers have this intense grazing program. So the goats actually graze from, you know, 7 to 7 at night or whatever between milkings on different pastures. And so the goats, when they're in the one pasture, they're not back in that pasture for 60 days kind of thing. So that we haven't had to worm our goats yet. It's been like 2 years, within 2 years or so.
And that's uncommon?
Yeah. Goats are like prone to get worms and parasites or whatever.
That's gross.
Oh, yeah. Goats. That's because they eat garbage, right?
They're pretty picky. No. They're not. Nah.
That's
I think
the
they're
stereotype.
Pretty
they're always yeah. like in the garbage
they're
pile.
They're into everything.
Eating your shirt.
Yeah.
They're extremely picky. They're very curious and they'll check you out for sure, but as far as eating, they're very picky. They want, like, the very best, like, third cut hay, if possible, you know, or second cut. And so, too, the other thing is all our hay that's grown at Consider Bardwell Farm, our farmers, we're all doing the hay. It's organic, so that's really cool.
Yeah.
That we offer that.
What's a day in the life of Leslie Goff?
A day in my life.
A working day.
Oh, so I start every morning at 5:30 at Consider Bardwell Farm. Wow. Yeah.
I hope you get home early tonight.
Yeah, I've already talked about that.
Angela, she's coming in late.
So I start at 5:30. We get the vats, two vats set up, ready to roll. Our pipeline all sanitized. By about 6 o'clock, there's milk in the hall tank that's ready to come into the creamery. So by about 6:15, we're pumping milk in. It's usually another cheesemaker, myself, starting first thing. Then once the milk's in the vats, we start heating the vats up to about 70 degrees. We throw in our cultures, depending on what cheese we're making for the day. And then we continue to heat that, add some rennet. We use microbial rennet.
What's that?
A rennet derived from mucor mehe, I think.
What's that?
It's an enzyme that makes the milk coagulate and form a mass. It acts upon those casings that you were talking about
okay,
earlier.
Okay, so for those of us who don't speak cheese science, basically means it's a vegetable-based
yeah,
rennet
vegetable
as opposed
rennet.
To an animal rennet.
Yeah.
And can you just talk real quick, like, the philosophy behind that? Because it seems, I was kind of surprised when I read it's always a vegetable-based rennet.
What's always a vegetable-based rennet?
The ones you use as opposed
the
to
ones
animal
we
rennets.
Use. So we switched to a vegetable rennet probably 7 years ago now because Angela's daughter was vegetarian.
Oh.
So, and we wanted to reach a larger crowd of people.
And Angela is the owner, the founder.
Angela is the owner of the farm. And so we wanted to reach a more, a larger crowd of people. So by doing that, we were able to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
So once we add the rennet, we go ahead and let the mass firm up and set. And then we cut it into the correct curd size that we want for the day. And we cook it. And then we drain the whey off. And then we're left with... we cook it, and then we're left with curds and whey, and then we drain the whey off. And take the curds and put them in plastic forms.
Okay.
And then press them upon... on top of one another. So that they continue to release whey. And the cheese kind of closes up so that you're not left with any kind of, like, openings of curds. You want it to be completely closed on the rinds. And then, so the cheese make is usually done by about 1, and then there's always cave work to be done because we age all our cheese in-house. So there's a lot of washing. I think we have, or I know we have 5 caves currently, so we were up to 6, but... So washing also entails literally a brush, like a small brush dipped in a solution, a brine solution, and handling every wheel of cheese in the cave and washing the top.
So cheeses in caves get washed every day.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, and generally if, you know, we have 5 caves, so 1 cave, we try to do 1 cave a day kind of thing. And not every single cheese is washed every single day.
Okay.
So usually, like, the Paulet Cave is washed twice a week, and the Dorset Cave is 3 days a week, and Rupert might be once a week. So we try and get the schedule, figure out the schedule with the staff and the cheese makes and the cave work and all sorts of cleaning.
Do you ever have days where you're like, I wish I just worked in an office?
No.
Great.
I don't. So, yeah. So, I mean, I work from about 5:30 to 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So, they're pretty long days, but at the end of the day, it's rewarding, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Making that crack.
Seriously, making that crack. Well, we're glad you make that crack, Leslie. And you can pick up Consider Bardwell at, I think, almost any of the green markets in New York City.
Yeah, I think so.
And at Murray's Cheese. And I know your website has, like, a huge list of distributors
all over the place. Absolutely.
Can your farm be visited?
Yeah, it can.
How does one do that? They just drive up there and show up?
Yeah, I think there's information on the website. But we have a farm store up there, and people can buy cheese and... goat meat and pork right there too. So
yeah, I know you guys have a Twitter that can be followed.
Yeah, Peter Henry is in charge of all
that.
Okay,
I think it's at Consider Cheese.
Okay,
she's like, I ain't in charge of the Twitter.
What is Twitter? I only speak cheese.
All right, well,
cows are my friends
and goats too. Well, eat more goats. It's Goat-tober, right?
Yeah,
right on.
All right, we're gonna take a break here on the morning after. We're gonna come back with the morning after quiz.
And this is another one from Keto. We'll be right back.
My 30th year to heaven, woke to my hearing from harbor and neighborhood, and the mussel pool and the heron priesthood.
Hello.
And we're back here on the morning after. Leslie is in studio, but Sari and I have been talking to
Leslie.
We're
all here.
We're all here. Leslie Goff from Consider Bardwell Farm. She's the head cheesemaker there. Leslie, it's time for the morning after quiz. Are you
exciting.
Ready?
Yeah.
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 Exciting. Scared. Okay. Fantastic. So, Leslie Goff, you know an awful lot about cheese, but what do you know about the pseudo cheese product loved by all Philadelphians, Cheese Whiz? Get ready for the morning after quiz. You ever had some Cheese Whiz in your day?
A little bit.
Oh, the cheesemaker has had the Cheese Whiz. You know, actually, I read that originally Cheese Whiz had cheese in it, and it doesn't anymore. That's really fucked up.
Just whiz.
Yep. Just whiz.
I'm not
just
surprised.
Whiz in a jar. All right. So first question. It's multiple choice. Question one. Cheese Whiz, the thick processed cheese sauce / spread, is not marketed in which of these countries? Which country? A, the Philippines. B, Venezuela. C, Brazil.
B.
You say B, Venezuela. You know, it actually is marketed in Venezuela. They like some Cheese Whiz there.
Oh,
it was
no
actually
kidding.
Brazil. Brazil does not get the whiz.
I was sure you said that so quickly. I was like, oh, she knows that. She knows her Cheese Whiz.
I think maybe she has the B system.
Oh, yeah. We've had that before.
Doesn't work for
it
you.
It never works.
Doesn't work for you. All right. Question two. Aside from the classic Cheese Whiz flavor, it also has several different styles.
Mm.
Which of these flavors is an actual brand of Cheese Whiz? Is it A, Cheese Whiz Italia?
Italia.
Is it B, Cheese Whiz Nacho Party? Or is it C, Swiss Cheese Whiz?
B.
B, Cheese Whiz Nacho Party? No, it's actually not Cheese Whiz Nacho Party, but I think the Cheese Whiz people out there should really call me about some Cheese Whiz names, because Cheese Whiz Nacho Party is amazing. Actually, it's Cheese Whiz Italia.
Oh my gosh, really?
Wait, that's the one that is or is not?
Nope, that is one. Yeah.
That's crazy. I would never have thought that.
I think they should call it Formaggio Whiz.
That
it's Italia.
That would never work.
I think
people would be like, I don't know what this formaggio is. Well, it's not distributed in Italy anyway.
Why would it only be the New Yorkers who would buy it?
What do you think is in Cheese Whiz Italia?
Herbs and spices.
It's like tomato, basil, maybe?
Ugh. Real Italian.
It's like real Italian salsa, corn, fromage. I don't know.
Why is it nacho party, not nacho?
What do you mean?
Nacho party.
Nacho party, yeah.
Instead of just nacho.
Sari, I don't have the answers.
Your mind works in mysterious ways, Jesse Keeper.
It does. Okay, so final question. I'm hoping you get one right. Why did Kraft food scientist Dean Southworth invent Cheese Whiz in the early 1950s? Is it A, he was trying to come up with a speedy alternative to the cheese sauce used in Welsh rarebit, because people made that a lot here in the 50s? Is it B, Kraft teamed up with Sports Catering International to find a quicker way to melt cheese on cheese dogs at their ballparks containing human DNA, I imagine?
Probably.
Or is
also
it
dogs.
Is it C, he whipped up an umami-packed cheese sauce for fondue night with his wife, and they loved it so much he decided to pitch it to Kraft?
Oh my gosh. A.
A, yes. It was the Welsh rarebit. I have no idea what that is. Yeah!
Ooh,
a bell. Well done. Well, you didn't win, but you got one
That's
right.
Okay.
Do you think they used the word umami in the 50s?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm sure they made fondue and all of that stuff.
Nonstop. That's all they
like,
did.
That was date night in the 50s.
Oh, I miss the 50s.
Yeah, me too. Well, Leslie Goff from Consider Bardwell Farm, thank you so much for being on The Morning After.
Thanks for having me.
For coming all the way.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's go get some crack. I mean, cheese.
Happy cheeses.
This is The Morning After.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.